It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
In 2014, we had a parent complain that her student had received an inordinate number of days out of school for suspension because he was Hispanic.
So the Obama administration realized that this was a problem across the country, that Black and Latino students were being suspended and expelled at higher rates than white students. And so they created this policy around how states and districts could lower school discipline disparities. PBIS, positive behavior interventions and supports, is just one of these types of programs that's meant to keep kids in school. And the point is to focus on changing positive behavior rather than excluding students.
Walking in the hallway with a hug and a bubble. A hug and a bubble is a creative way of saying use a voice level 0, you wrap yourself and you blow up a bubble.
This is a really multifaceted, complex issue to really get your hands around. The program has no impact on the chronically disruptive. We focus on the 1% and don't really seem to be concerned about every other child that's not getting the education that they need because someone's disrupting day after day after day.
Secretary DeVos got together groups of educators from around the country, and they expressed some concern about some of the tensions around the particular policy. And so she's currently considering rescinding the policy.
The teacher was educated to become a teacher. They're not sociologists, they're not social workers, they're not counselors. We shouldn't expect a teacher to have those kind of skills.
We build relationships with our students and our families so that they know that they get second chances. So even if we mess up one day, when we come back, we can do it over and it'll be a better day.
That was a Wall Street Journal report just about a month ago, 2018. This is Sandy Rios in the morning with you. You know, our public schools have become a mess, shall we say. Most recently, we sort of think they're a mess because we're seeing all these mass shootings, and certainly that's an indicator. But long ago, they went off the rails. And those of you that have children in public school probably know that. Those of you that are teaching certainly know that. And actually, when we talk about this, I can't think of anything where I get more email and more comments. This is a very serious problem in our country, and yet there's very little happening to address it. I was recently with a teacher friend of mine, and we got into some very long conversations. And because of her experience in public school, because of her wisdom, I have asked her to join me this morning to talk about her own experiences, what she's seen and is seeing firsthand, what it's like to be a teacher right now. Are children learning? Is there any hope for improvement? What's it like, especially, to be a Christian teacher in the circumstances that we're going to sort of lay out? We're going to talk about all of that because I knew that you would enjoy hearing from her. And because she's still working, we're only going to use her first name. You know, it's dangerous, actually, for teachers now to speak out. It is. So we're going to use her first name and just say that she's from the heartland of this country. Her name is Carol. She joins me this morning. Carol, listen, I appreciate so much you being willing to speak out in this way, even before you say a word. So thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, so let's start with this. When did you graduate from college?
Yeah, a long time ago, Sandy, 1977. I've been teaching for 40 years.
40 years. And what was your major?
I was a music education major.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you remember your very first assignment in a classroom?
I do. It was 7th and 8th graders, And there was a huge learning curve, as you can imagine, trying to go from the theory to the practice. But it was 7th and 8th grades. Right now I'm teaching kindergarten and first graders. And although there's a difference in the age from the beginning students I taught till now, there's also just a huge difference in what I see with children in general.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. And, you know, Carol, I should say, you know, you might not even know this. I think you do, as well as we know each other. I studied to be a teacher. It was music, and I spent...
I remember,
Yes, I remember. You'll like this story because one of my first assignments was teaching middle school English, and it was a year-round school, and it was a three-month position only. And I was 6 months pregnant with my second child. And when I went in, I had all this musical experience because I was a singer and had done all these things. And the principal was really liked my resume, and he said I had the job. And then he said, as I was walking out the door, you'll be teaching guitar. Which I never played in my life. So what happened was every seventh grader had a guitar in this makeshift classroom. There were 36 of them, and you can imagine what they did with those guitars, Carol. The reason I take time to tell that is just so as we talk, because I have never been a teacher like you. I started to be that. I've had some experience, and so I'll be talking with you about some of my perspectives about that as we go along, too. Mm-hmm. All right, so how many grades have you? I mean, it's kindergarten, first grade, and you've also taught middle school. Has it been music or other things?
I've mainly stayed in the music field, and now I do some adjunct work in the education department at a local university. So it's either teaching teachers or doing some music with the little ones. So,
Let's go back in time. 1977, you graduate, and I'm surely not long after that, you probably found a position. How would you describe, from your perspective, American public schools at that time, Carol?
Well, we're never talking perfection, but there seemed to be a greater amount of, I'm just going to call it innate respect. The teacher was an adult, and they were treated a certain way. Parents expected the students to treat the teachers in a certain way, or all adults. And this is one of the things that I think is sort of the demise of education right now, is that there isn't a general understanding of this underlying respect for the adults in children's life in general. You know, there's always people that don't fall into that category, of course, but just in general, we've lost some natural respect for adults, I believe.
And I don't think hardly anyone would disagree with you on that. But let's now talk about what that looks like. Because you are, as I understand it, actually asked to go down to the smaller children because it's getting so complicated. But even with them, you shared with me a few stories that were just hair-raising. And so let's talk about those. I mean, what kinds of things, you're trying to teach a class, what kinds of things... Give us a story of why, an example of children not having regard for a teacher or authority.
Well, in a way, teaching the little ones has been just, I feel kind of sad in some ways, because they are coming into us with just truckloads of emotional issues to the point where our special education population is significantly increasing, not due to autism or Down syndrome, but behavioral disorders. And we're talking 6 and 7 year olds that see psychiatrists weekly and even have a personal aide to bring them to class because their behavior is so extreme. And so sometimes children come in with their own personal aid, so, you know, you can talk the finances of that. But anyway, they come in with an aid, and if I think of this one little boy, I'm going to call him Johnny, if you give him any direction, you know, oh, Johnny, here's where we're sitting, then he will immediately disrupt your class because he will not accept direction. And so once he came in late with his aide and the children were in front of the smart board doing some things, and I said, oh, here's a seat for you, Johnny. And he basically starts screaming and running around. So that makes it, you know, obviously very disruptive to the class. And so the aide went to follow him to try to keep him from doing all that. Wasn't very successful. And at some point, he started jumping up on his seat. I was worried that he was going to fall, so I stopped the class. And I went over to him, and he immediately fell to the carpet. I mean, intentionally went down to the carpet. And later, after talking to my principal about this incident, I was asked, did you pick him up? And so I had taken his little hands and, you know, brought him to his feet, not roughly or anything. And I was told that I was not to touch him because that wasn't allowed. So I said, well, you know, he was very disruptive to the class, so I was going to just get him up and get him outside the classroom with his aide. He said, no, you're not allowed to touch him. And what happens is this little boy knows this. You know, he may be a little six-year-old, but he knows that no teacher can take charge in that way by asking him to get out of the room because he can't be touched. So you are, you know, I'm sacrificing the other 20 in the classroom during the time it takes for him to stop screaming and running. And it's kind of a theft of education, isn't it?
It's, yes, you said, just to repeat your words, a theft of education, a theft for the other kids in that classroom.
Right.
So when he knows that a teacher wants him to do something, he falls down.
Right.
And then you are not allowed to touch him. So
right.
Is this the same student, Carol, then, that you ended up having to call the principal because he was so disruptive later?
I remember asking the principal, well, if I can't cause him to exit, you know, I'm not talking rough or anything, but just causing him to exit by touching him, what should I do? And the principal said, well, you will call me. So the next time that happened, and it's kind of a frequent occurrence, and I called him, and he came in, and now there's two adults to this child, his aide and the principal. And I must say, the other children, the regular kids, are kind of practiced at looking at me and trying to follow me while the ruckus is going on. I give them a lot of credit. They try to focus, and I continue with class. But it took 45 minutes for the child to be able to get up on his own because they weren't allowed to touch him either. 45 minutes of a class before they could get the child to get up and walk out of the class. And so during this time, he would see some things that he wanted to join the other children doing. And so the principal would say, I think he's ready to join you now. And I said, I would really like him to follow the first direction that I gave him, because the whole class, they may be little children, but they know that I gave a direction to this child, and it wasn't a difficult one. It was join the class and sit here. I would like him to be able to do that, so for next time, then looking down the road. And the principal went back and tried to get the child to get up and sit in this spot to no avail. And at some point, and maybe the third try, he said, I don't think he's going to sit there like you asked him to do. So let's just have him join the circle now and we'll work it out later. So it's the kicking the can down the road.
Yes, Carol.
And
hold that thought. The point is that the principal caused the child to completely ignore your directions.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing to be gained. The classroom was disrupted and you were helpless. And this is just one child and we're just beginning. My guest is Carol, who's a 40-year teacher veteran, and we're going to continue with these stories. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Now, Our first question, 1 + 1. Yes.
2.
Incorrect. Yes.
Multiculturalism.
Well done, Simon. Next question, what is 3 × 3? Yes?
9.
Wrong. Yes, Penelope.
Gender equality.
Very good, Penelope.
Is this a joke?
You think gender equality is a joke?
No, but isn't this a maths class?
Don't be so racist.
I just asked a question.
We don't ask questions. Questions are offensive.
All right, that's a little clip. We play this often because it's so appalling. And, of course, it's supposed to be funny, but it's very dark humor. It's more like 1984 George Orwellian humor about the education spelled with a K. We'll put that on our Facebook page, as we always do when we play one of those clips, because it's shockingly realistic. My guest is Carol, who's been a teacher for 40 years. And those of you that are teachers, I'm sure that your ears I don't know if you're energized or depressed by hearing what she has to say, but you can relate to this. I know you can, because I hear from you. Carol has been teaching for 40 years in the Midwest, and she's still teaching, and that's why she has to be a little guarded, because teachers, like other professions, are in fear for their jobs. If they talk about common sense and managing kids and actually teaching truth, it's a challenge for any honest-minded person to be in our public schools. And that's why many of them are leaving, and that's why it's making our education system even more weak. Carol was just telling us about, she has a student, this is just one student in her kindergarten first grade class, who cannot control his behavior. He has an aide who is with him all the time, and the kids now know, and he knows, and other kids know as well, that they cannot be touched. And it means the teacher can't touch them, the teacher can't discipline them. The principal, as I understand it, in this situation, I don't know how to describe the talk, but it's kind of like the teacher you heard in that clip, where it's just another world, trying to reason with this tiny child rather than just make him mind, which is kind of the old school way of talking about it. Carol, you said this, there's a one child with the aide, but this is not unusual, is it, for kids to have these aides?
No, it's becoming quite common, because the school does realize that this little boy I was just describing, he would not be able to function at all, because directions are given rapidly in the classroom. You know, please sit here, come over here, do this. And since he is resistant to any instruction, any request, he would not be able to function. So there are children that just need an adult to walk alongside them. But my problem is, even with the adult, there is so much potential disruption because of how it is. There's a huge emphasis, Sandy, on not shaming children. They use that word a lot. You don't want to shame children. There's even a poster in our school, several places. You should always, love the word always, you should always feel good about yourself. Now, that comes from a worldview that, doesn't compute in my thinking. Children, none of us are naturally good, so we shouldn't always feel good about ourselves. But if that's the current philosophy, things result from that kind of view. So in the old days when you gave information, no, Johnny, don't do that, that is cheating. No, don't do that, that's called lying. Nowadays, they would say, please don't do that. That's shaming a child.
I had an interesting experience on an airplane a couple of days ago. I was sitting behind, I have to say, this is not uncommon. I've had this experience on airplanes before, but I'll describe this young couple, real sweet looking, with a two-year-old child between them. And this is how it went. Both parents leaning into the child. Johnny, do you want this book? Do you want this book? And then he screaming, ah, oh, look, here, do you want this book? Oh, here, how about this treat? Here, grandma, mom's got this. Here, dad's got this. Just constantly, then he would scream. And then they would say, well, how about this book? Well, how about this toy? How about, and it was that way the entire trip. And honestly, Carol, I thought they probably thought they were pretty good parents because they managed to keep him from screaming constantly. I think they felt they had managed him. But I'd love to know your thoughts about what you're seeing with parenting and how that story might play into what you're seeing.
Well, I just feel, in fact, it's more than feeling. I know that children feel secure when they are given boundaries and when there's no fence in their little view and they just can see far into the horizon, they feel unsafe. And so, you know, teachers and parents that are not in charge, and I don't mean that phrase as in military, rough, gruff, no, not at all. Just kindly putting down some boundaries. I call it in teaching gentle insistence. You insist, but you do it gently. And the children feel much more secure when they know that this person, this adult in their life, is in charge. You can show great love and concern for a child, but be in charge. And, you know, to think that in your airplane example, that this little child could be the one in charge is frightening for that child. I mean, it's going to be terrible down the road for the parents also, but for that child to not give them the security of knowing you are not in charge, lucky you. Someone's got is in charge of that. We're okay. We've got you. It's such a sad thing for the child.
I think so, too. And I think one of the byproducts of that is that you make your child feel like they are the center of the universe. And they're not. And they will find that out. Even if you don't teach them, they will eventually figure that out. And it can be quite traumatic. When you're, you know, into college and you don't you realize the world doesn't revolve around you and your opinions and your desires. And the other thing is you're not disciplining, you're managing behavior. That's very different. It's like a responding as opposed to leading, like you've just
teaching.
Described. Yeah,
teaching. It's teaching.
Carol, I don't know if you feel free to share this, but I recall you talking about a conversation with a parent who said that the behavior you described, the child's inability to follow instruction. Okay, do you mind telling that story?
Yes, this was actually a middle school child, and he was, you know, old-fashioned word, we call it obedience, right? They don't obey the instructions. On a spiritual level, we want our children to obey so that they will learn to obey Christ, too, someday. It's a learned thing. You learn to obey. But anyway, this little middle school child would not follow directions routinely. And so I had a parent conference, and they said, that's not at all what we see at home. He's totally fine. Heavily inferred, it must be you. You know, you must be asking unreasonable things. So after a little bit of dialogue, and I could tell we were not understanding each other, I asked a series of questions, and he sort of went down this vein. Do you ever ask him to clear the table after supper? No. Do you ever ask him to take out the garbage? No. How about do you have a time when he has to sit at the table and do his homework? No, we don't do that. Do you have a specific time that you ask them to go to bed? No. And I think it probably drew it out a little longer than necessary. I probably asked them six questions, but the answer is always no. And at the end, I just said, well, here is the problem. In the course of teaching a class, many instructions are given. You know, please raise your hand before you talk. Make sure you're listening when somebody else is talking. These kinds of instructions. And that's when I see the behavior, asking him to do something that he doesn't want to do. And I think he did understand at that point. The conversation kind of ended soon after that. But, you know, if you never ask your child to do anything, you aren't teaching your child. And I think there's a great setup for failure in school and in life in general because of what you said. They think they are the sun in the solar system.
Do you think that parents, is there like a manual or a popular teacher right now in parenting that's causing so many young parents to take this passive role in parenting? Like In some ways they're passive, but in other ways they're just hovering, just constantly right. there, constantly entertaining, constantly interacting, holding, whatever. But in the other ways, they are passive and they're just responding to the child, constantly responding. Is there someone who's actually teaching this that you know
well,
of?
Well, I do know in the intro, I heard a clip about the positive behavior, and a lot of states have adapted PBIS, Positive Behavior Incentive System. And it's rewarding the children with physical things, you know, pens, candy, like a reward for doing, for behaving. And my personal philosophy is that gets in the way because they are thinking of the reward, not what their behavior should be. In other words, I don't believe in rewarding someone for doing what used to be just expected. There's this level of just expectations in a classroom or at home. And I mean, I've heard of people who pay their children to try a new food, for instance, parents pay them money. So this whole emphasis on positive, nothing to shame them, nothing to tell them that they did something wrong, just positive. I don't think it works. I just don't think it works. I don't think it changes the behavior the way they hope it would.
Are you seeing any parenting that is bucking the trend? Do you have an idea of a percentage of kids in your class that you think are actually being well-parented and are doing their best to survive in this kind of a classroom?
Yes, there are plenty of well-behaved children. It's interesting because, you know, it's not scientific. I haven't put it on a graph, but many of the children that are typically very well behaved, they're also churched. There is a connection. So
interesting. Well,
a lot
all
of
right.
children now are just not churched at all. You know, in my era, many people went to church, whether they were Christian or not, and now that's sort of not as commonplace.
You used the term earlier, theft of education. And just for a second, talk about that, Carol. As you, I know you do music, but I also know that you're widely read. That's not your only, you know a lot about a lot of things. And you work with other teachers. How do you think this is affecting their information intake, their knowledge of the subject matters, the other kids, the whole class?
Right. It's actually simple math. I have a friend who teaches in the big city public schools, and he's a good guy, good teacher, very knowledgeable. And I said, wow, it really must be something. He's teaching eighth grade science. And I was talking about this whole thing. How do you teach to the children who want to learn this while managing this off-the-wall behavior? And he actually said, and, you know, he's experienced, he knows what he's doing. He said, some days I'm just happy if they're able to stay in their seats. Now, not a lot of science is getting taught if that's what the end result of that day is, they stayed in their seats versus roaming around and creating a ruckus. So, you know, it's simple math. If you add up all the minutes that a teacher is, even if they're really good at, you know, just getting the class to stay with them, you are distracted by poor behavior. So if you add up all the minutes when you're saying, oh, Johnny, no, come sit here, make sure you're quiet, or whatever you say to get them to get back into the class activity, you add up those minutes. So they're minutes that you are not teaching. And we're very hyped in the public school about educational minutes. We care about that. But somehow in that conversation, it never comes up all the wasted minutes, which adds up to hours that, you know, little Susie is sitting there waiting for the other person to sit down and pay attention and not take away their their turn, so to speak.
Do you ever feel like in your classroom that you are, do you ever have that sense of the gratification that comes from being a teacher? Do you ever feel that anymore? Do you have that sensation,
yes.
That pleasure?
Yes, I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it. And so even though I am telling you the downsides, I use this kind of expression. I close my door and I teach. So I ignore what I need to ignore, and I do have gratification because it is great to see the little light bulbs turn on. But I am not an ostrich. I can see the problems. I can see what's happening with our children. Obviously, not all of them, but a big portion of them, and I agree with it.
Yes, I know. Yeah, don't we? I mean, it's this tragedy. It's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
My guest is Carol.
Mm-hmm.
She's been a teacher for 40 years in the heartland of the United States, and we're not done because there are a lot of other issues, even besides discipline, happening in public schools, as all of you well know. And we'll try to get some of those in when we return. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
John Klug was an orchestra teacher for Brownsburg High School for 4 years. He says he was given 3 options, follow policy, resign, or be fired.
I feel the compelled speech of forcing a teacher to take a side on this very highly controversial topic is a violation of our First Amendment rights.
At the beginning of the school year, Klug says he received an email from the administration instructing teachers to refer to transgender students by their new preferred names, or what Klug calls their newly assigned names reflected in the school database. He refused and submitted a conditional resignation letter with a tentative date.
Let this sit on your desk until May 29th, and at that time, I'll allow you to submit a letter of resignation to the school.
But he says days before that May 29th deadline, he withdrew his resignation.
Why did you hand them the initial conditional resignation?
Because it was my understanding that I would be suspended pending termination May 1st.
I'm very disappointed. Very, very saddened.
Jim Bohr's daughter was in Klug's orchestra. He defends the teacher's decision to stand by his beliefs and wants the school to rehire him.
He was coerced. I have no doubt about that.
LGBTQ organizations disagree.
Showing a lack of support for transgender youth is what drives up the suicide rates of transgender youth in Indiana. Indiana leads the nation in youth that consider suicide, and things like this contribute to that.
Now, the district says Klug voluntarily resigned prior to the end of the school year. They accepted it, and they are in full compliance of state and federal laws. No response, however, to accusations that they forced him to resign.
I think Sandy Rios back with you. I think it puts it in perspective a little bit for all of you to understand why it's probably an act of courage for Carol to be joining me today to talk about what it's like to teach in public school right now. Because she's a Christian also and has been teaching for 40 years, and it's getting increasingly more difficult. And I don't think that there's anything, certainly I've covered this since the 80s. I remember, and in the 90s when I started on radio, the movement of the LGBT wave started at the NEA, the National Education Association. They made tremendous inroads with a video years ago called It's Elementary. And it was nothing more than a propaganda video and a way to force teachers really to embrace some of the early acceptances and tolerances of lesbians and gays. And it was resisted even in New York City. It was very controversial. New York teachers fought back on what they call the rainbow curriculum then. And then it proceeded, was very successful. And I don't need to explain to you what's happened now in public schools. Children are being forced to embrace and accept all manner of sexual behavior, and their innocence has been, and I will use the word raped, taken from them at the earliest years, even in preschool. in order to somehow justify the homosexual lifestyle. Carol, you're in the thick of this. And so the most recent, of course, push on public schools is the one John Klug got fired over, and that's the transgender issue. And I, if you, as much as you can say about it, I would really appreciate your perspective. What's going on with that in your school?
Well, we have that in our school, and yes, you're required to call the student by the new name, and I find it so interesting talking to my colleagues, because when they say something about the students, like so-and-so did this, they immediately need, their speech increases, start talking faster, and they say, I'm totally fine with that. Whatever she wants, it's a he that is now called a she. Whatever she wants, I mean, that's fine. I'm good with that. And then they go on. It's always a parenthetical, quickly delivered, I'm totally fine with that. I hear that all the time. So it's there's a lot of pressure for the adults in the place to toe the line and say, it's fine, I'm okay. So because the adults are all saying that and acting like it's okay, they send a message to all the children in the class that it is fine and it's okay. So it's, you know, how people say you learn more by watching the teacher than hearing their voices. And I think we teach all the time when we don't even know we're teaching. And when they are completely accepting of the things that come down the pike, that teaches our children that it is totally fine and acceptable.
Carol, let me explain something, because I made some assumptions when we started this conversation. Some people don't really, I think, still understand what we're talking about. What's happening in public schools around the country, not in every one, but pretty much. Now it's this an Indiana story that just came out. That was Brownsburg High School, I think, outside of Indianapolis, where the teacher was just fired. Kids who, and it can be children too, can be young kids, doesn't have to be teenagers, who suddenly think that they're boys when they are biologically girls, or think they are girls when they're biologically boys, just have to make that known in public school. And then the teacher now is forced to use the pronoun that does not comport with their physical gender, and the name. Usually they're, at least this happened in Massachusetts. Carol, you can correct me in a second if this isn't the case with you, but Massachusetts was one of the first states to adopt this. The kids, they gave the child a name of the gender that they wanted to be. And in Massachusetts, at least, teachers and administrators were forced to use those pronouns and names during the day, and also required not to inform the parents that this was happening at school. So some parents did not even actually know about this. So now, how does that comport or compare to your policy at your school, Carol?
Yes, and I don't know if the verb is forced or it's just expected. You're expected, you know, the information comes out, this person is now this person, and you're just expected to go with that. So, you know, they have a different bathroom and that. And it's kind of interesting because some of my friends who quickly say, I'm fine with that. One who has a daughter also attending the school wasn't so sure they wanted the boy to be in the daughter's bathroom. You know, it sort of breaks down when it's your own child sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's something, and it may be a completely different subject matter, but it brings to my mind. Sandy, unfortunately, you can't believe how many elementary children are addicted to pornography already. It's really, really sad. Because you talked about them losing their childhood. That's part of it. The internet use without proper parental supervision, it's doing a lot of damage to our kids, little kids.
Are you talking girls as well as boys?
I don't know about, I have not heard about the girls, but I've heard about plenty of the boys. We're talking like 9-year-old boys, 8-, 9-year-old boys, and they're already addicted. So it's just
Yes. Well, you were right in the middle of the darkness, honestly. You'd think the public schools would be a bastion of innocence, but you are really right on the firing line, the experimentation block of the left, and are in many ways ahead of the rest of the culture. You know, I had a friend who moved to a different state. They had a teenage boy, and the schools where they moved were much more, shall we say, progressive, even though we know it's regressive.
Right.
He would go to the boys' bathroom. I think he was 15, and kids would be having sex in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I said to my friend, how can you leave him in that school? If you were working in your workplace and you couldn't go to the restroom without that happening in the bathroom, would you stay working there? Wouldn't you? I mean, this is your still young son. And so my point is, that was a long time ago, Carol. And schools have just, it's incomprehensible. Incomprehensible. Now, let me ask you, when you mentioned boys primarily that you know of being hooked on pornography and grade school boys, I'm assuming that plays out in the classroom with the way they treat the girls, does it?
There's some of that, and there's just like occasionally I've seen just very inappropriate gestures and that sort of thing. And it consumes, as we know, it's just a real consuming evil. And to have it on children, it's just heartbreaking to see. It's just heartbreaking.
Well, I think you've already answered these next few questions, but I'm going to ask them anyway, Carol. So, what's it like to be, especially a Christian teacher, operating under these circumstances?
Well, I mean, I can teach. I mean, I'm not, I still can present material and have the children learn. If that's fine. But there's kind of a undercurrent. I'm kind of heartbroken many times when I see some of the children and what they carry on their little tiny shoulders that they should not be carrying. And there's just a little heartbreak there when I see little children. I do what I can. I call it giving information. I give information that I'll call it what it is. No, that was lying. No, that was something. You know, I give it a word so that they have the information. Because in a world where everything is, it's subjective. There's no absolutes for these children. I remember we were talking about something, I guess it was a song that was an African-American spiritual we were talking about. And it referenced the story of Noah and the ark. And this little, nice little girl raised her hand and said, well, that's a myth. And I just thought, again, it's just kind of pervasive sadness. I'm thinking she had no base for her life, no rock. It's just subjective and full of myths. And I feel sorry for them. I really do.
So for teachers listening to this conversation, Christian teachers, there are a lot of them, Carol, still, you know that, in classroom. What would you say to them? I mean, what keeps you going, and what do you think, I think you've answered this too, but what is it that you think they should make as their goal to accomplish?
Well, as Christians, our goal is to show Jesus. So, you know, he was kind, he was compassionate. So we treat our children with great respect. We show them love, affection, we're kind. And we also, a goal would be to, here's my phrase again, gently insist, make sure there are boundaries, make sure that they feel safe in that classroom, not safe in the current use of that real safe space, but safe because you've given them some boundaries and you've given them affection. So we're not replacing their parents. We're not changing their their world, but in our classrooms, we are doing the best we can to show them what we should, Jesus, and I'm not saying it well, but our goal is to be in the workplace what we're supposed to be, wherever our workplace is, and so mine's in the classroom, and I'm happy to be there, but I see some things that make me sad.
Carol, one last thing, and we're going to be out of time. In fact, 30 seconds. Parents with kids in public school, what would you say to them?
They need to talk to their kids about what happens every single day. You know, what happened? And then you're sort of debriefing them. Like, would that seem right to you? And how can we talk about that? So it's just lots of talking to see what's happening and what you can say to tell them truth in the middle of the dark.
All right, Carol, this has been so valuable, as I knew it would be. And so thank you for kind of laying it out here in a vulnerable way when you're still working. God bless you and protect you and prosper you and give you words you never even thought of to speak to those kids. And our hearts go out to the nation's children, to our children, and to our teachers. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.